It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Utah's best athletes count on flexibility, speed, strength.
And the Jazz pick up their 22nd assist.
So they count on University of Utah Health.
Brielso Lake puts this game away.
And so can you. Leading doctors, a world-class environment, award-winning innovation, care to be great.
14 unanswered by the Utes.
University of Utah Health, caring for Utah's best and yours. Schedule your appointment now at uofuhealth.org/care to be great.
Welcome into the Jazz Notes Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Anderson. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Ben's Hoops. You can read me at KSLsports.com, and you can like us and subscribe in iTunes. A very special guest, one of my favorite people on earth, certainly my favorite person to talk basketball with, longtime assistant coach in the NBA, including right here with the Utah Jazz. It is Coach Gordy Chiesa. Coach, how are you?
Ben, I'm doing well. Thank you.
Coach, this has been better than I expected, the bubble I'm talking about. And I want to talk about the basketball first, and I do want to talk about the actual bubble and the environment and what you think that would be like and if you've experienced anything like it. But just initial impressions on what the first, I guess we're what, a week in now as of Thursday, which is today, we're recording this on a Thursday. This has seemed really successful to me.
Very much. It's been so great for the NBA to have the games, and they're so highly competitive. What's interesting is the style of play, the intensity level, and that the players are really fit. And the games come down most times to less two or three possessions. And the NBA, as far as without any COVID-19 upstarts, is that they're able to get this going, and it's really been surprising in a positive way. And the intensity level of the players is really just very similar to the regular season.
And I think that's what's surprising. I understand there are situations where the fans not being there has certainly felt weird, and it feels really weird late in games where a basket doesn't get this, you know, it doesn't feel like the entire momentum changes on every basket late. But the players don't look less engaged to me. The players seem excited to be there. They seem happy to be there. They seem really focused. The coaches seem focused. Other than a couple of the media interactions are a little bit more difficult than they usually are because you're not in the locker room and close and kind of have that intimate space. I think it's been very recognizable to me as somebody who covers the NBA.
The watch has been really interesting, and the ratings are good. So I know it's August right now, so philosophically, most times in the summertime, ratings are down because people do a lot of different activities. However, because of the pandemic virus, many folks are home. So the overall ratings of the games are solid. And the most important thing is that very coveted 18 to 49 demographics, and that's been really regular season numbers. And I looked it up the other day. The Bucks-Rocket game was the eighth most watched ABC game of the whole season. And the other ones were Christmas Day or whenever the Lakers play on ABC. So the fans are watching the games, and they've been rewarded by it.
So let's talk a little bit about your experience coaching, and then we'll get into the Jazz because I think the Jazz have actually been pretty fascinating, and I think there's a lot of storylines there. Have you ever done anything like this, NCAA tournaments, when you were a head coach, when you were an assistant coach, coaching overseas at all? I mean, have you experienced anything like this?
No, I have not. No. I've been involved in basketball since 1973, so it's been 47 years. And this is the first time ever that, minus the lockouts. Now, I was involved in two lockouts with the NBA, but this is totally different. This is when you could have played, but because of the pandemic virus, they literally stopped the season. So during the lockout situations, season didn't start, so you played less games. So it's the ability for the players to focus. That's been the most impressive thing. The better teams get it. Some of the lesser teams that are just fighting for the to try to stay alive, they're usually talent short. But the teams that could be championship-type level, they're ready to roll, and they played well.
How much was routine a part of how you coached? Because, you know, I did a dinky little radio show for 5 years, and I remember if something happened early in the day or right before a show that would throw me off, I felt like I could feel it throughout the rest of the day. I could feel it throughout the whole show. It threw me out of my rhythm. How much of that existed for you? Because it seems like I've been surprised at how these players have found a rhythm inside the bubble.
Yes. Well, that rhythm is done because the intensity level and the energy by their teammates and floor mates. So in a team sport, even when you're struggling, your sidekick on the court will pick you up. And so, again, the better teams have a bunch of sidekicks that are positive, and that helps them to regain their rhythm. Usually speaking, the two areas that the three-point shooting is slightly down overall, and that's because of most times it's leg strength and foot drive, and the second thing is that there's way too many turnovers. Usually they're unforced. So the overall three-point shooting is slightly wayward, and the ball as far as security has been upward, and that's been a problem for the teams.
Speaking of rhythm a little bit, one of the things I was listening to the ESPN broadcast the other day, and of course your old friend Jeff Van Gundy was on, and he mentioned you. He was talking about how you guys used to coach together, and he actually had a funny anecdote about how Jerry Sloan told you could only have, was it 5 minutes for a pregame speech for the players as you were preparing them?
Yeah, I was back in this was back in 1989, where I did all the scouting for the Jazz as far as with the team, as far as talking to before the game and during the walkthrough about what we're trying to do defensively and offensively. So a long time ago, Jerry said to me that we've got to keep it short so the players can concentrate. So basically it was 5 minutes of hopefully organized dialogue. And Jerry always told a story about when he played and the head coach, Dick Motta, and the old school blackboard with the flying, I call it flying chalk in his hand, would be diagramming 7 or 8, 10 plays on the blackboard, and Jerry was saying to himself that, please stop, to himself internally, I'm guarding Oscar Robertson 25 minutes from now. I don't care what play, the two play, two up, two side, two down, it's irrelevant. I'm guarding Oscar, so I get myself ready to play. Let's fast forward it. That's smart coaching by Jerry and all the other people in this generation, where less is better. So a huge factor of NBA success is the players. As coaches, we might know a whole bunch of things. It's irrelevant. It's what the players can absorb during a game without slowing down their feet.
I do think I look at Jerry Sloan, and he feels so raw as a head coach compared to what we see now, and how calculated they are, and how big staffs are, and the numbers, and you know, everything that goes into it. And there's certainly a science to it, and it's certainly important. But it's not like Jerry was unrefined. He had experienced the game playing his whole life, and then failed as a coach early on in Chicago, and then got another opportunity and rounded into one of the best head coaches. He wasn't just making it up as he went along. There was a science to it, even if he didn't feel like a scientific guy.
Yes, and that science was the system of ball sharing and playing help-to-helper defense. And again, it sounds so trivial, but it's not. It's a huge component as far as successful teams. When the ball moves, the scoreboard moves. When the ball sticks, the scoreboard sticks. And that simple axiom of saying that helps the team offensively to score with fluidity. I call that partnership scoring, where everybody's sharing with the ball. Now, some other players with unique talent will have the ball more. I get it. But if you don't touch the ball that often in a game, you don't feel as far as you're part of it. And there's a little trust factor with your floor mates. So a huge reason why teams are successful, they ball share and they play solid help defense. And that was the system the Jazz put in. Yes, we had some once-in-a-lifetime players, but it's who you play against also. Now, this generation with the Jazz right now, they're more three-point shooting, and that's good because they have good three-point shooters, and they have a dominant scorer in Donovan Mitchell. And Jazz of yesteryear, it was a total game schematically of moving the ball and sharing it, and that was a great recipe to high success.
Was Jerry a great basketball mind? Because we look at some of these guys who, you know every X and O and know every in and out and every play and how to counter everything, and we talk about these geniuses of basketball, and Jerry seems like And not even a player's coach, because he didn't seem necessarily all that approachable. He was very no-nonsense. At least that's such an outside perspective of it, and I would think that would be most people who grew up watching Jerry Sloan would say that. Did he have a great basketball mind? Did he have all those things that good coaches have?
Oh, very much. Absolutely. And you talk about, I call it upbeat discipline. So in other words, so when teams are successful and reach their potential, there is discipline. Now, within that discipline, it has to be a human factor so that the players have to understand that there's one person in charge and that person wants you to succeed as far as individual player. I never knew a coach that didn't play players that had the best interest of the team winning. Now, it gets cloudy because with the immaturity of some of the players, how they view the world and how themselves. But Jerry was a sound technician, and again, less is better. So what the Jazz, in other words, the Jazz did a whole bunch of playing and less talking, philosophically, versus with some of the teams, especially in this new age generation where a whole bunch of talking and less playing. And when I say less playing, I mean what? Less winning. Most NBA teams' talent level is in the same level most times, with a few exceptions of once-in-a-lifetime generational talents. So what makes a team... What makes a team not be successful, usually speaking, it's the things behind the scene. On the court, it's what? Lack of help defense. It's what? Usually lack of physicality. It's a lack of ball sharing. I keep saying lack. Why teams do win is the direct opposite, where they do all the little things, and they do it as a collective group.
Let's talk some Jazz basketball, because they've been pretty interesting. They had a really good win, a nice comeback victory down 16 with a minute to go in the first half. They came back and beat the New Orleans Pelicans. I thought they looked atrocious against the Thunder. They looked okay against the Lakers, but were out-talented by guys like Anthony Davis and ultimately LeBron James in the fourth quarter. And then I thought everything kind of came together after a bad first quarter, and the Jazz played maybe their best basketball within the bubble in a win over the Memphis Grizzlies.
And that was a 124-115 win by the Grizzlies, and that snapped the Jazz a two-game losing streak. In that game, Ben, Joe Ingles was really aggressive. It was a breakout game. He shot 6-for-11 from three. Before that, for the first three games, he's only shot 3-for-11 from three-point range. So his 25 points and 5 assists was absolutely crucial. And Mike Conley, playing against his former team, meaning the Memphis Grizzlies, he also was very, very good. He's aggressive scoring. 23 points, 7 assists, and 5 rebounds, including 4-for-9 from threes. So Mike Conley has played well in the NBA restart. He's averaging 19.9 points per game in the four games, including 3 times 20-plus points. And, Ben, it's interesting, from the foul line, Mike Conley is 21-for-21. So he's focused as far as his foul shooting.
What are you seeing from Mike Conley? Because he's interesting. I've done a couple of radio interviews, and I've talked to people about how he's playing, and he doesn't have these long stretches where he takes over a game. Like, I will watch Donovan Mitchell, and he'll have a game where he scores 24 points or 23 points and has 7 assists, which is what we've seen from Mike Conley recently, and it feels like he has such a huge impact on the game when he does it, and I'm talking about Donovan. And then so often, and I've even seen other local reporters kind of tweet this after the game and say, wait, Mike Conley had 20, or Mike Conley had, 28-4, or 24-8. What's going on with Mike Conley where it's quiet, his numbers don't seem to, his impact doesn't seem to jump off the page, but clearly the numbers are there and he's helping the Jazz win.
Yes. Well, the reason why part of it in a good way is Donovan Mitchell's brilliance, that Donovan has the ball a lot of times, and as far as the optics, he's a dynamic scorer and a whirling dervish as far as a playmaker, making some spectacular passes to Rudy or to kick out for the three-point shot. Mike Conley's more cerebral, more steady the way he plays. He plays the game on the ground. Donovan Mitchell plays the game up in the clouds. And so there's just two different how you view things. Now, as Jazz go forward in the playoff run of this year and the next year when they get back Bojan Bogdanović, is that they've got to figure how to use Mike Conley as far as his steadiness to play in lockstep with Donovan Mitchell. So this whole first year has been a feeling out process where sometimes there's been mixed results, but as we speak right now, he's find that spot where mentally He's able to score the ball and shoot better. Let's not forget, Mike Conley's a 37.8 career three-point shooter. So he's really a good three-point shooter. Now what he's got to do is take that often, especially out of team rhythm.
So looking at the Jazz then, I mean, it seems like Mike Conley's locked in. I think Donovan Mitchell's playing well. His assist numbers are looking really good as well because he's having to play a little bit more point guard or playmaker, and I think a lot of that's a result of Bojan Bogdanovic being out. Why have they looked lackadaisical at times? I mean, why did they look so bad against the Thunder? And maybe the Thunder are just extraordinarily good because they walloped the Lakers last night. They put it on the Jazz. They've been a tough I mean, they've put up tough games. And really, since Thanksgiving, they've been one of the best teams in the NBA.
Oh, very much. Well, the reason why the Jazz aren't as successful as we speak in the present tense has been really Jordan Clarkson. The Jazz starters have played well. It's the Jazz bench that's been lacking just philosophically. And the two Jazz losses with they've not been successful, Jordan Clarkson has shot 6 for 30 in the two losses. And the two Jazz wins, Jordan Clarkson has shot 14 for 31. And so it's dramatically, they need his scoring punch off the bench, and he's good at it. The second part of why the Jazz has some struggles has been their overall not valuing the ball. The Jazz are averaging 18 turnovers per game. And so to be successful in this type of environment, meaning in the bubble, where you're playing against other good teams, some elite teams, but all of them are good teams, the Jazz have been exposed as far as their lack of ball security. So they've got to improve that dramatically as those guys go forward. So starters have been relatively solid. The bench has been woefully lacking.
I've been critical at times of the Jazz for being overly patient with going out and fixing problems and you know trying to solve some of their issues. And then, of course, this last summer they went out and spent a bunch of money and they signed Bojan Bogdanovic, which I think has been a home run. They traded for Mike Conley, which has had mixed results. But as we talk about what have you done for me lately, he's been brilliant and looks like he can be a part of this team going forward. Here's my question. Now you're doing this very small sample size in Orlando in this weird environment with unreliable results. At least I think you could convince yourself that the results are unreliable. How much can you read into this and adjust what you're doing this offseason based off these last, you know, eight seeding games? And if you get a playoff round or if you get two playoff rounds, hopefully you get enough there to feel like you can make changes. But how confident are we in what the Jazz are and what they aren't?
The Jazz are a solid team. Now they've got to get more scoring. That's what they have to have. So they've got to get more scoring. They rely so much on Donovan Mitchell's brilliance as far as being able to create off the dribble. So in the offseason, and again, this offseason, it just sounds weird saying it, the offseason now will be in October. So October 18th starts the free agency. The college draft's October 16th. And so generally speaking, they're saying next year, unless they, and again, this is fluid, their practice starts next year on November 10th. So, quote, in the fall offseason, they've got to try to figure out how to get more scoring punch off the bench. Now, the Jazz are a good team. They got knocked out last year by the Houston Rockets 4-1 in a very, unfortunately, non-competitive series. As I've been saying for decades, is that it's not a playoff series until it goes 6 games. Up until that point, the games might have been intense, but if you get knocked out 4-1, the series has been really relatively non-competitive.
So what's a good scenario for the Jazz going into the playoffs then? Because I think the Thunder are really good. In fact, you know, I think the popular question has been, okay, outside of the Clippers, the Lakers, and Milwaukee, who's the dark horse that can win a championship? And Toronto was the easy choice. Some people pointed at Philly or Boston, and of course James Harden and the Rockets. Maybe the best answer, at least that I've seen so far in the bubble, and like I said, they've had this great record since Thanksgiving, maybe it's the Thunder, because you've got a very heady, proven star in Chris Paul who knows how to manage games and has seen everything on the floor. They've got a ton of young talent. They're really versatile defensively. Steven Adams does what you need, which I think is just rebound, and he's solid and doesn't make a lot of mistakes. I think they're really good. I don't know if they can beat Milwaukee and the Lakers and the Clippers in a playoff run if they have to. That might just be too much talent. But I think there's a chance that they could rise above. They could make this push. Is there a team like that? Are they in that category?
Well, they could be as far as their sister starting lineup for the listeners right now. Chris Paul is a major proven veteran that controls the game. the young star heading to be an NBA All-Star is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who is a combination guard that can score, and he has wonderful talent. Lou Getz Dort is this undrafted player out of Arizona State that's defensive-minded, timely three-point shooter. Danilo Gallinari is a proven stretch four, and then a town bully in Steven Adams. But what it makes interesting with the Thunder, when they close games out, they use Chris Paul, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and a Dennis Schroeder. So they go three-guard offense with Gallinari and most times Steven Adams. That's their finishing team. But they've gotten good play out of this another young guy named Darius Bazley, and Hamidou Diallo has played well for them. So is Terrence Ferguson, and so has Mike Muscala. And so they're really deep. Now, from the Thunder's point of view, let's not forget, they got knocked out in the first round for three consecutive years. Last year by the Blazers, 4-1. 2018 by the Jazz, 4-2. And 2017, Rockets, 4-1. So even though they're playing very well, historically, they haven't overcome that. But now they have Chris Paul. And so Chris Paul could be the single biggest factor of his experience, especially that middle game. There's nothing regular about the playoffs. You play a certain way regular season, the playoff comes, you need people that can drive the ball to the basket and make mid-range jump shots or be twist layup shooters, because that's the shot of choice in playoff games. It's not the three, because the three-point long ball, the defense is going to stay at home on you. It's the middle game that wins for you.
Denver's also looked good. Michael Porter Jr.'s really had a breakout. He's had two 30-point games already. He's just big and long. And then you look at Oklahoma City, who we were talking about. They're big and they're long. It seems like that's just the future of the NBA, which we wanted to go traditional five positions, and we kind of morphed out of that, and we said, okay, well, small ball works, and you look at what Houston's doing, and the Jazz right now with Bojan Bogdanovic are extremely small outside of Rudy Gobert. And then you look at these other teams, and you say, okay, maybe it's not small. Maybe it is these tall, long, lanky, versatile defenders who can shoot threes. And it's not small ball. It's a long ball, because you're just trying to get as many threes up as you can, like the Jazz did against Memphis when they took 45 three-point attempts. I think that's a good number. But you also have to be able to defend players, and you have to be switchy and versatile. I do think you need two or three guys at least that are 6'5 to 6'9 that can guard four positions on the floor.
That is correct. Right. So the versatility of the wing players, so that those rangy, athletic people that can guard 1 through 4, but more importantly, be able to block off the boards and get climbing rebounds or chase down missed threes. So those teams that have guys like that, so for example, the Denver Nuggets, you just described Gary Harris, Will Barton, Torrey Craig, and Michael Porter Jr., and also vastly underrated PJ Dozier, who fits that bill as far as being athletic and playing. And then the other guys would be like Jeremy Grant,
yeah,
as far as Nuggets have. It's another guy that's that can guard different multiple positions and the versatility. Usually speaking, from a coaching standpoint, when a team has their back to the wall, they go ultra small. So most times, teams will match down as far as playing the five best players versus trying to go traditionally more size and balance the floor. When you're losing during a playoff series, you have to be more radical as far as your five best players, no matter who it is.
So who is the best matchup? That's kind of where I was going, and I know I got derailed talking about styles of basketball. Who's the best matchup for the Jazz in the first round? Because we know they've struggled with Houston, and Houston's actually looked pretty good in the bubble as well. Oklahoma City's looked absolutely dominant. Denver's actually been really good as well, but maybe the Jazz match up better with Denver? Maybe they don't.
No, they do. The answer is yes, they do. Denver would be the best matchup for them. The Rockets, the way they play with so many wild card scorers and James Harden, and also with Russell Westbrook, they're a hard team to guard because how they go ultra small, but the Westbrook factor and James Harden makes it almost impossible, where you don't want Donovan Mitchell or Mike Conley to get in early foul trouble, because then suddenly we talk about the steadiness of Mike Conley or the dynamic scoring of Donovan Mitchell now negated because they're in early foul trouble. So if that was the case, the slightly best matchup would be the Denver Nuggets because they're more traditional. So the Thunder with Chris Paul would not be. But again, in the playoffs, unfortunately, you can't choose your opponent, and everyone has the exact same concerns. Where, hey, by the way, if you're the opposition, how do I guard Donovan Mitchell? What about Joe Ingles? What about Rudy Gobert in that short corner spacing for the lob option over the top when Donovan Mitchell penetrates? Every team has the same dilemmas. The most important thing is that how you correct it, if not during the game, how you be able to adjust. The games are so close, one or two slight adjustments, but without going away from your core philosophy, could be the difference of winning and or losing.
Find him on Twitter at GChiesa, oh my, longtime NBA assistant coach, including right here with the Utah Jazz, Coach Gordy Chiesa. Big thanks to everyone who's tuned in to the Jazz Notes podcast today. Again, like us on iTunes, give us a review. You can rate us there as well. You can find me on Twitter at Ben's Hoops, and we'll be back with another episode of the Jazz Notes podcast next week.